This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from an expert in making fire-resistant landscapes. He'll be visiting the Central Coast to share his advice on the best ways to clear and manage plants on properties.
When you remove everything around a house, down to bare ground, you basically create a wind tunnel.
Also, it's apricot season in parts of the Central Coast, but that's not all coming from one orchard.
A Pouat is a hybrid of apricot and plum. I have nectarcot and nectar plums.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 29th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. We begin this week's show with a story about generational farming that goes back hundreds of years through booms and busts. Controversy and the emergence of a crop we've been talking about a lot recently, cannabis. Before we get to what some have called the green rush in California, we'll start with another popular green plant, avocados. Here's KCRW's Jonathan Bastian from their podcast about the Central Coast, the 805.
On a recent afternoon, I drive out to Carpinteria to meet Ed Van Wingerden. He runs Everbloom, which has both greenhouses and orchards, like the one we visit. Just as we begin walking around the acres of avocados, he checks in with one of his workers.
Hey, espera un momentito, salud tío. ¿Exactamente qué vamos a hacer con esto?
Es a fertilizante para hacer los avocados que están de no tienen aserrín.
Ah, los que no tienen aserrín. Yeah, okay, muy bien.
What were you guys chatting about? What were you asking him?
He has chicken manure, so because again, we are certified organic, so we cannot use the conventional chemical fertilizers.
Van Wingerden planted these avocados in the early 2000s. But his family's history of farming goes back a long, long ways.
Yeah, so we go back to about the mid-1700s in Holland. I come from a little town called Naaldwijk. And so we stayed in the same place for hundreds of years. And it was always farming. It went from open field farming, wheat farming, orchard farming. And then finally, some of the first kind of greenhouses, I suppose.
His father, looking for new opportunities and a better climate, came to California in the early 60s and built some of the early greenhouses in the region. Initially, they planted flowers, especially Gerber daisies. The market in the U.S., he says, was wide open. And for decades, business was really good. So they expanded, built more greenhouses. But that changed dramatically right around the Great Recession in 2009. A series of economic events pummeled the industry. The U.S. growing market collapsed, and cut flower production shifted to places like Canada. To diversify, Ed Van Wingerden branched out and grew avocados. He says Carpinteria is the ideal place to grow them.
Carpinteria is Camelot for avocado trees. I mean, it truly is. It has the perfect temperature. We are much cooler, for example, than San Diego, which means we can hold our fruit much longer. And we'll pick about off of this ranch, which is 34 acres, we'll pick about 600,000 to 800,000 pounds a year.
But as successful as the avocados have been, it still left Ed Van Wingerden with a giant financial problem. All of those greenhouses. The family was trying to support a dying industry, and the money was drying up, fast. Thankfully, another crop was emerging just at the right time, and it grew perfectly in greenhouses. Yes, cannabis. Growing pot wasn't something that Van Wingerden had thought about, or even particularly liked.
I come from a very, really, deep down, we come from a pretty conservative family, and so I never did. Marijuana. I didn't do it in college. I never did it. It didn't really appeal to me. It was not at all interesting to me to do this. We had several different people approach us. And for quite a while, I said, son, we can just stay the course. You know, let's just get really efficient. Let's get into robotics. Let's see if we can get our cut flower production going in such a way that we can just stay the course and grow cut flowers. It was just not sustainable. So yeah, we had no choice, and fortunately, the right partners came into town, and this is close to 5 years ago, and that is when we made the switch.
To learn more about the switch, we went to check out some of these greenhouses. Anyone who drives the 101 has probably seen where they're located in Carpinteria. They go on literally for miles. The Van Wingerden family owns a number of them and grows cannabis on about 10 acres. This is where I meet Ed Van Wingerden's son, Yvonne. He's in his early 30s and is the youngest generation in this long line of farmers. He walks us through a greenhouse filled with thousands of cannabis plants. About a dozen workers are busy trimming a small section of them. I joke with him that it looks like a sea of green.
So you're familiar with that industry term?
No.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, so this growing style, which is basically lots of smaller plants, is an industry term they call it sea of green. Huh. So it's an appropriate name.
And as simple as it might seem to grow these crops, he says it's pretty high tech.
This is all, very fancy Dutch climate control computers. Of course, we're monitoring it daily. We have two people. That's all they do is just check the climate computer and the growing area. It's a very involved kind of process, a lot of data and just checking, you know, time periods and settings and making sure that the hardware is doing actually what the computer, the software says it's doing. And
they also have a clone room where they isolate the exact strains they'll eventually bring to market. We then step outside and look at another piece of technology that's become representative of a troubling issue in the community, which is odor.
So what this is a vapor phase odor control system. We have a 6-inch perforated pipe that goes around the entire perimeter of the greenhouse, the entire growing space. And what it does is every 10 feet, there's a pre-drilled hole, and we create a curtain of this vapor around the greenhouse. And while vapor sounds mysterious, it's really quite simple. All this is, it's from a company called OMI, and it is water, food-grade surfactant to mix the water and the essential oils. So there's a proprietary blend of essential oils. They're all plant-derived. They're quite expensive. This system runs us, it was about $55,000 to install, and then it's about, it's over $20,000 a year to run it. So it's a significant item on our balance sheet to keep it running, but it's worth it because it's so effective. And so we have this thing running 24/7.
And from what I can tell walking around the facility, it is effective. There is little to any odor. This is particularly important because the greenhouse is located within blocks of Carpinteria High School, and there have been complaints that the stench of cannabis is infiltrating classrooms. I ask Yvonne if he thinks the complaints about odor have been warranted or not.
Well, I think odor as a nuisance, I wouldn't say that those concerns are overblown, because there are times when it smells like cannabis in town. There's no denying that. Right now, not every cultivator in Carpinteria has odor control. Our CARP grower, C-A-R-P, which stands for the Cannabis Association of Responsible Producers, we're a member of that in Carpinteria, and it's like high on our list of priorities, because even though we might have effective odor control, if someone down the road doesn't, we still seem to get the finger pointed at us because we are closer to kind of these more sensitive receptors. Like while we're outside of that setback, we are the closest person to be blamed. So we're very motivated to get everybody with odor control. Recently, the County Board of Supervisors had a ruling on that to try to speed up the process, which we're very much in agreement and grateful for. As a farmer, it feels strange to be asking regulators to regulate more, but in this case, especially with most things regarding cannabis, we need the regulation, and we need to have the rules set in stone and enforced.
While Yvonne acknowledges that odor has been a problem, he does not agree with another related critique.
You know, some people have said that there's health effects associated with the odors from cannabis or from the vapor phase systems. Those are completely safe. The FDA does not regulate any biogenic VOCs or terpenes because they don't have to. They're all safe. So cannabis, like a tomato plant or a pine tree, emits terpenes. And there isn't any scientific reason why cannabis would be toxic, but a pine tree VOC wouldn't.
Beyond odor, there's one more controversial issue surrounding cannabis. And the Van Wingerdens have an interesting perspective on this. Remember all those avocado trees we visited a few minutes ago? Well, here they come again. Earlier this summer, a number of avocado growers got a strange call from the companies that spray their crops with pesticides via helicopters. These companies said they could not continue spraying out of fear that the pesticides would drift onto neighboring cannabis grow sites. Cannabis, by the way, needs to be completely pesticide-free in order to sell. So, to avoid any potential legal trouble, the companies simply stopped spraying. This, as you can imagine, cast a relatively unflattering light on the cannabis industry, which was viewed as disrupting older, more traditional crops in the area. But Ed Van Wingerden sees it differently, primarily because he grows avocados organically and doesn't rely on helicopters to spray.
This is where I have a little bit of trouble with the standard avocado growers, where it's kind of like, guys, get off the couch and maybe, you know, get on your tractor and spray with a hose, and which is what we do. And together, I've got close to 60 acres, and we do everything by hand, so to speak. Not by hand. I mean, it's still, you know, a PTO-driven tractor with a tank on it, and we have two hoses coming off, and we spray certified organic materials like safer soaps and things like that. So it is extremely doable. And as I mentioned before, I mean, this ranch can generate anywhere between $300,000 and $500,000 more per year because it's certified organic. That pays for all my labor. So financially speaking, it makes total sense to just get away from the old conventional styles of spraying nasty chemicals and just going organic.
While these questions of pesticide spraying and odor control slowly work themselves out in the courts and county governance, the Van Wingerdens find themselves in a very different place from where they were 10 years ago. Instead of being part of a dying farming industry, they're part of a new, thriving one. They now employ around 250 people locally, way more than they did before. Still, when they reflect on where they've come with this transition to cannabis, it's strange. Here again is Yvonne.
Yeah, I mean, my grandfather, my dad's dad, when he met Ronald Reagan, I don't know if this is true, but I heard he didn't wash his hand for a week because he was just so enamored with, you know, that president. But we look at this as just like any other plant. Honestly, cannabis has helped so many people. It is a medicine. For years, we grew it medicinally, and there was a lot of wonderful feedback we got. I think that differentiation, it was a really important factor in not feeling like we were participating in something illicit or wrong.
His father, Ed, thinking about how far they've come, feels similarly, if not a bit more surprised.
When I was planting it, like I said, about 5 years ago, I was next to my son and my foreman in the greenhouse, and I said, "Hey, son, I mean, who would have thought? Who would have thought?"
For KCRW in Santa Barbara, I'm Jonathan Bastian.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Tyler Pratt. Moving now from Santa Barbara County to San Luis Obispo County, KCBX's Tom Wilmer recently got to know more about the role Camp San Luis Obispo plays as a California Army National Guard training base. The garrison commander, who is also a Cal Poly grad, tells us about the base's state-of-the-art training facilities that are used by military and civilian agencies, both federal and state.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Camp San Luis Obispo, California. Right now, we're with Lieutenant Colonel Brian Windsor, who's the new base commander. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming out to Camp San Luis today.
It's great to be here, always. And I was surprised to learn, pleasantly, that you're a Cal Poly grad.
Yes, sir. Yeah, this is home for me. And so getting an opportunity to come back, you know, to where I started my military career has been absolutely fantastic. It's a dream come true.
When you were at Poly, were you ROTC?
I was. Yeah, I was Cal Poly ROTC class of 2002.
So you always knew it was going to be Army?
I did. You know, I was one of those students. I was a Cuesta transfer, and I transferred over to Cal Poly. I just saw all the cadets and soldiers out there, and it looked exciting, and I wanted to be part of that. Have been ever since.
What's your specialty?
So I'm a field artillery officer here in the California Army Guard.
And when did you take command of Camp San Luis Obispo?
It's only been a few months. We took command in April of this year. Been a real busy few months since then, though.
You live in Los Osos.
I do. I've been living in Los Osos since about 2015. I was previously assigned here as the Public Works Director, so I've had a chance to live in the Central Coast again for a while.
Even though Camp San Luis Obispo is right on Highway 1 and right on the outskirts of San Luis Obispo, inside of the gate, most people, most civilians, don't know what goes on here.
You know, it's really true. I talk to people all the time when they ask me what I do here, and I say I'm at Camp San Luis Obispo, and they'll kind of look at me with a funny eye. Is that place between Cuesta and the sheriffs? And then I get to tell the story, which is great, and I love doing it because we're a really busy place doing a lot of good stuff here.
Let's talk a little bit about the breadth of primary missions that take place on an ongoing basis here.
Yeah, so actually what makes Camp SLO unique is that it's the state base in the California National Guard. So what that does for us is it kind of creates the context for us to have all these relationships with other state entities. We host the California Cal OES's training wing here, CSTI, as well as a cyber joint project between the military department and the state in Cal Poly.
And CSTI is the Office of Emergency Services out of Sacramento, and it's also melded today under Homeland Security, correct?
It is, and in fact, we do a lot of stuff with them for Homeland Security and for FEMA and pretty much every government agency between a municipal safety up to federal agencies train with them.
And again, even just talking about OES for a moment, the breadth of their mission is really fascinating. Hazmat, anti-terrorism, earthquake, a lot of very fascinating ongoing training programs they do.
It is. They do a lot. And, you know, California is really at the forefront a lot of this training because, you know, every year we have a really active fire season. And so we get to kind of put into practice everything that they train year round.
You even have a fake city.
We do. So we have a lot of different facilities to try and replicate what our emergency responders and our guardsmen and soldiers will be exposed to when they go out in California to support civil operations.
In the Army, it's called schoolhouses. You have a couple schoolhouses here, correct?
We do. So the California National Guard hosts the RTI, Regional Training Institute, here at Camp San Luis Obispo, and that is the unit that is responsible for a multitude of different training activities for individuals and classes.
So whether you're enlisted or an officer, you might decide you want to become an MP, for example, military police, and you would come here for that training?
Yes, the MP school is one of the schools we have here, as well as the 88 Mike, which is our truck driver school, and the officer candidate school is managed here by the RTI as well.
So again, being part of the California National Guard, do you primarily draw troops from around the state for training, or could they well be from across the country?
They are. They're from across the country, for both military students at the RTI, and Cal OES draws their students from across the country as well.
And a little bit more on the breadth of primary missions here.
You know, first and foremost, our mission is to train soldiers to fight and win our wars and support the state. So that is and always will be our first mission, and we do that with our various ranges we have and our facilities for training staffs and quite a bit of medical training as well.
And it's interesting that when people look at the Army and they look at the Cal National Guard, you think of military. You think of military deployment, but there's also that civilian component, civil disorder, earthquakes, the fires in the Sierras.
It is, you know, and that actually makes up a lot of what we do here, and it's why I love working here, is the relationships that we have with the other state agencies that are responsible for conducting this training, and we do it together, and it's just a great experience.
And then one more shared admiration, Grizzly Youth Academy, which is on base. We agree, a great, awesome program.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Grizzly is kind of our shining star here. The youth programs within the California Military Department, they're all fantastic, but Grizzly is certainly their standout. They've been a real success story for everybody that comes through there.
As a little insight on Grizzly, this is for high school kids that are still civilians in high school. They haven't gone off the edge yet, but they're primarily at-risk kids. And so they come here for what I think 5-6 months, but then they go back and rotate back into their high school or get a GED here.
It is. And you know, it's a fantastic program in that when the students come here and they graduate, when somebody's here long enough to see how a student grows from the time they get here to the time they graduate, it's really incredible. But it doesn't stop there. They have a really robust mentorship program that follows the students, that stays with them.
And that's for another, I know, at least a half a year. And that's one of the things I'm most proud about Grizzly. A lot of the boot camp programs around the country, they fall down because there is not that follow-up. Where Grizzly, when you leave Camp San Luis as a kid, as a graduate, it's not over.
That's right. It's just another good example of how the military department can leverage soldiers, really, to help people not in a what we would classically think of as a defense role, you know, helping out students.
When you were at Cuesta College, you were right next door, and you'd look in over the gate. What did you know about Camp San Luis Obispo?
Well, see, I was one of those. I didn't know anything. I was right here as a neighbor for a couple years, and I really had no idea. And even really when I was with ROTC at Cal Poly, we trained here a couple of times, but that's it. I didn't have a real good grasp at the time of just how big Camp San Luis Obispo was and how active they were in the community.
You have some firing range way back hidden in the hills, some different obscure training areas. Tell us about some of the crypto stuff.
Yeah, we do. And so like I mentioned earlier, you know, our first role here is to train soldiers. And we do that with our ranges. And so we have quite a variety of different actual firing ranges and then also some pretty sophisticated simulation ranges too, of which there are very few throughout the Army. And we're bringing one online here. It's going to offer us some additional capability.
And that's virtual reality?
It is. It simulates firing in a variety of situations, and the new system actually allows soldiers to move as they're firing. So it adds that much more reality to what we're doing. It's some pretty great stuff.
What sort of different tactical programs would happen within that lab?
So the basic shoot and move combination is what we try to train there. You know, it's one thing to be out on a firing range in a static position. It's a whole nother thing to be moving, you know, with your battle buddy downrange and shooting at the same time.
This would be rifle, pistol, 50 caliber.
Yeah, rifle, pistol, and a squad automatic weapon also.
So fascinating. This is so a whole platoon might be in the exercise or a detached group of a platoon.
Yeah, we can put pretty big groups through, but the building that houses the facility right now can handle about a fire team, so about five people at a time, but we put large groups through.
So there's an infrastructure on every military base that the day-to-day operations, the civilian support, the permanent party people that keep the base running. Talk to us about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have, at any given day, we have between 70 and 80 folks that work in the full-time staff to kind of keep the base running from our public works department, our operations, our telecom. It's really just a small version of a full-blown city operation that we do here. And then on top of that, there's about another 450 or so employees at the camp that aren't part of the headquarters but work here.
Are you the mayor?
I am the town mayor. Yes, sir. It feels a lot like that sometimes. I deal with quite an array of different issues, but that's what I love about it.
Talk to us about some of the major training exercises that happen on an ongoing basis.
So we run through, I was looking at the numbers again the other day, about 100, just over 170,000 people for training last year. And it's a huge variety of training, from individuals qualifying on their weapons to training staffs to entire battalions coming in and establishing their base operations. And we just wrapped up a couple weeks of annual training where we had entire battalions out here in camp.
And what were they focused on? What were they doing?
So we had a maintenance battalion, a logistics battalion, and they came out and set up their headquarters, and they're responsible for providing the needs to a field artillery brigade that's not here, but they were able to replicate all of their tasks and everything they have to do and train on everything right here behind our USPFO, or what used to be our USPFO facility.
Going back in time, this was originally called Camp Merriam, mm-hmm. and it was, from what I remember, the original home of the California National Guard, true?
Yes, that's true. In fact, you know, we celebrated our 91st birthday this week. Camp Merriam was originally founded in 1928, and it's gone through a lot of phases. We were originally the home of the California National Guard and the 40th Infantry Division. It became a federal installation to support training for World War II, and then handed back to California after that.
That whole buildup in World War II, I mean, it was something like they built basically a whole base in 47 days in the rain.
They did, and there are some great pictures out there of what Camp San Luis Obispo used to look like, and it's just tents and buildings as far as the eye can see out here in the Chorro Valley. It was a pretty incredible sight to behold.
I remember a photo showing the base at its full max World War II and where CMC is, that was a parade ground, and the base was all the way down to there.
Yes, back to CMC and over in Cuesta as well. And that's back when we were about 15,000 acres. We're at about 5,000 now, and we used all of them. Yeah, we had somebody everywhere.
Cool. And you had the USO here, and you had some pretty major stars that came to the base in World War II.
We do. I think there's a picture floating around there, too, of... this is after World War II, but of Tom Selleck, who was a California National Guardsman and spent some time here at Camp San Luis Obispo.
A little bit more about your cyber training.
Sure. So the cyber training complex we have here is a good example of the military department coming together with academia to try and solve, you know, the most complex problems of the day, and that's cybersecurity. So we have what is the start of, I'm sure will be a very robust and fruitful relationship between the military department and Cal Poly. And it, actually, I should mention, too, we host the DA's cyber forensics program here also, adjacent to the cyber protection, cybersecurity teams. So there's just a lot of really good information sharing going on in the cyber domain.
Talk to us a little bit about projects.
Sure. So if someone were to come out here right now, they'd see that our Grizzly Youth Academy is doing a pretty big project here on their campus, just ahead of when the students come back, improving their own MWR facilities.
MWR.
Morale, welfare, and recreation, making it just really a nicer place for the students to be when they're not studying. Some other projects we have coming up next year is some improvement to our training facilities. We're improving our ranges to bring them up to the current Army standards for training ranges for the new weapon systems. And we're also building a 1 megawatt solar facility. We're blanketing our warehouses with solar panels, and it's going to provide all the power for the base here.
Oh, wow. Very cool. And community engagement, do you ever open the doors and have an open house? Or?
Yes, we certainly do. You know, this is great territory, and we don't want to keep it all to ourselves. So we'll periodically host hikes of Sierra Romaldo right here behind us. And we've also hosted some fitness events, athletic events, and runs on the base to kind of, you know, open the doors so people can see what's going on here and not just be one of those passersby on Highway 1 wondering what's going on over there by Cuesta.
And how does somebody learn more and engage with Camp San Luis as a civilian?
Well, we try to have a fairly robust social media profile so people can find us on Facebook. You know, if you were to just Google Camp San Luis Obispo, you would get our splash page in the military department that has all the range of contacts where people can get a hold of us.
Lieutenant Colonel Brian Winsor, Base Commander, Camp San Luis Obispo, and Cal Poly grad. What a pleasure and an honor to spend the morning with you.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, Tom. Thanks for coming out. I really appreciate it. Anytime I can have an opportunity to talk about, you know, what we do here to the community is fantastic.
You can catch more of Tom Wilmer's interviews on his Journeys of Discovery page on kcbx.org. Thanks for tuning in to Issues and Ideas. I'm Tyler Pratt. In the last segment, you heard about what the California National Guard does to fight wildfires, but what can California residents do to help try and protect their own homes? One idea is to manage native plants on your property. And one expert on the subject says he believes much of the conventional wisdom you've heard about native landscapes and fire is wrong. Greg Rubin, the president and founder of California's own Native Landscape Design, is based out of San Diego. He says a significant number of the landscapes that he's worked on have been involved in huge fire events, and so far without the loss of a single home. Rubin says on many occasions, neighbors on both sides, unfortunately, lost their properties. Rubin will be in San Luis Obispo this week on Thursday, August 1st at the Slo Vets Hall from 7 to 9, where he'll be sharing techniques that he says he's developed to create sustainable, ecologically responsible, and fire-resistant landscapes. And I recently spoke with him over the phone before his visit. One of the things that you say you're going to be speaking about is the difference between thinning and clearing the space around your property or structure.
Yeah, that's really important. So there are two things that drive me crazy when I hear the media describing these fires and their fuels. So, you know, everything becomes fuels, or, you know, we got to clear the brush around our house. And when they say brush, it's this broad sweeping term that includes everything that's growing, especially outside of developed zones. What people don't realize is what they're calling brush, a lot of it is non-native. I mean, all the grasses you see growing on those hillsides around San Luis Obispo are practically non-native, and they are flashy fuels. And when you disturb and clear, what returns are all these non-native grassy cow pasture weeds, which go up simultaneously, you know, 100 acres at a time. And they're incredibly dangerous and incredibly fast moving. And so I like to make a distinction between chaparral and just calling it all brush. And secondly, is this term clearing, because clearing implies that you're going to take it right down to bare ground and you're going to remove everything within that zone around your house that they specify, anywhere from 100 to 300 feet out, which is a massive amount of habitat loss. And one of the interesting things after the 2007 Witch Creek fire here is when I went in there right after the fire came through, I was noticing that so many homeowners had cleared for hundreds of feet around their homes, yet their home was just a pile of rubble, maybe with some green lawn and green palm trees growing around it. And, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, fires jump freeways. You know, how is a 100 to 300 foot clearance zone around the house going to be any different? Well, I used to be an aerospace engineer. I did that for 9 years before I decided to follow my passion for California native plants. And I remembered, you know, some aerodynamics from my old aerospace days. And what I realized is when you remove everything around a house down to bare ground, you basically create a wind tunnel. And a easier way to put it is you create the perfect bowling alley for embers. And so when you clear everything around the house, there is nothing to stop those embers, to create turbulence that causes them to go up in the sky instead of straight for your house. And the only thing to stop and catch embers at that point is your house. I mean, the ember attack is amazing in these situations. It's like the old fire falls of Yosemite going sideways 70 miles an hour with zero humidity. And what we found and what we're testing is that if you give a little bit of light hydration to your landscape, it can actually become quite fire resistant. And what we further found is it takes so much less water to make native plants fire resistant. So we think that's what was going on in a lot of these landscapes. And so the reaction intensity, in other words, the amount of BTUs per square foot per minute, goes way down with these lightly irrigated, hydrated native landscapes. And this may be the reason that we, you know, knock wood, haven't lost a home yet.
Now, instead of clearing, you do talk about the idea of clearance, about three times the height of lower vegetation between, say, the understory and the bottom branches of trees. Can you dive into why it's good to keep that space clear?
Yeah, and this also goes with this idea of thinning, which I should have touched on. So, you know, instead of clearing to bare ground, what we recommend if you have native vegetation growing around your home is to thin it out by about 50%. It looks like that number, give or take, is a good number. Because when you thin the coverage by 50%, you're actually removing about 70 to 80% of the potential fuel volume. And you basically carve out a nice, clean, native park, a mature native landscape from impenetrable chaparral, and you get rid of the weeds in the process. So that's what we recommend as far as modifying fuels. Now, when it comes to this clearance between the bottom branches of a tree and the growth growing under it, we usually try to maintain a gap of about three times the height of the vegetation underneath the tree. So if the vegetation under the tree is 18 inches high, then we try to maintain a minimum of about 4.5 feet between the top of the understory vegetation and the bottom branches of the tree. That way it discourages what we call ladder fuel. Instead of if the understory is reaching up into the canopy of the tree, then the fire can literally ladder up into the tree and start a crown fire. So we try to maintain a gap of about three times whatever the height of that vegetation under the tree is.
So if someone listening right now, as we approach a hotter time in the year and a more intense, possibly part of fire season, what's one thing they should be doing if they don't have the time or the resources to do all the things that you're going to be listing off in your talk on August 1st? What would be your number one suggestion for people?
The number one thing that people should be doing, especially if they can't afford to put in a full-on landscape at this time, is what I call site hygiene. You basically work from the house out. So you go around the house and you see if there's any wood piles, any debris, any wood sheds right up against the house. Get them away from there, at least 30 feet away, but certainly at the bare minimum, not underneath the eaves. Also, if you have plants growing right under the eaves of your house, cut those back severely, okay? Or even remove them and put an apron around the house. One of the best protections we've found is to put a 3 to 4 foot wide decomposed granite or gravel or concrete apron all the way around the house. That way there's nothing to burn directly under the eaves and then lick up into the rafters and start, you know, penetrating the house. The other thing is get rid of your weeds. And if you have native vegetation within 100 feet of the house, prune out all the dead branches, prune them up so they look like small trees, and get rid of the non-native grass and mustard and stuff like that that dies out in summertime and is ready to burn. That will remove that fuel. It will remove those fire ladders. And it'll allow the native plants that remain to be hydrated because the weeds aren't robbing the moisture and destroying this ecology. So the plants will have more moisture to themselves to be better hydrated. And the whole thing will look nice, you know. It'll look like your own little mature native park. And if you have time to maybe even put some paths through it, maybe even throw a bench or two out there, you've got mature, drought-tolerant, beautiful habitat vegetation just waiting to be cleaned up and utilized. And you will have very good erosion control, tons of birds and butterflies. You know, it just goes on and on.
We've talked a lot about the landscape and plants. What are some ways that people can make their own house fire resistant?
Yeah, I think this is actually the most important factor of all. And certainly in San Diego, our codes have come, building codes have come a long way. And most of our modern construction actually does pretty well in these fire events. But just some basic things to do is make sure your eaves are boxed in so you don't have exposed rafters. Make sure that you've got a fire-resistant roof and not shake shingle. The siding should also be fire-resistant. A lot of people like to use the concrete-based hardy board. The vents need to be screened with quarter-inch or smaller wire to keep embers from getting into your attic. One of the things that really saved a lot of homes was the fact that they had double pane windows and metal frames. One of the problems with these vinyl frames is they literally melt and the windows just fall into the home and then you're wide open to embers and fire. And one other thing around the immediate outside of the house where the fence comes in, and typically it'll make a 90 degree turn into the side of your garage or side of your house, and you'll have a gate there typically. Instead of that little section of fence being wood, it's much better if it's masonry and the gate is non-flammable. It's amazing the intensity of fire that can be generated by a 6 foot wood fence, and having it go right into your home under your eaves, it just wicks right in, just brings the fire straight into the house, and then you're off to the races. So if you can make that portion of your fence out of masonry wall and, say, a metal gate, then that's also going to be really helpful should a fire come through.
Greg Rubin, president and founder of California's Own Native Landscape Design. He'll be speaking on August 1st at San Luis Obispo's Vets Hall from 7 to 9, and the topic will be fire-safe plantings and landscapes. Greg, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to coming up there and talking to you folks.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Finally today, the apricots on the Central Coast are ripe for the picking. What are the ingredients needed to produce the best crop ever, and what recipes can we find them in this year? Father Ian Dellinger hits the orchard in this month's Playing with Food.
Mikey!
Right, all the way through these trees. This is KCPX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. I'm traipsing through the orchard, following Patrick to find Mike, hearing a whistle of one of the crew who is completely invisible, somewhere within the grove of overburdened fruit trees. Good morning, Mike.
Hi there.
Hi, I'm Father Ian, just as a reminder.
I remember.
Thank you for having me out here today.
Yeah. My name is Michael Cerrone, and I am a fruit grower in Sea Canyon.
You said that I would see a lot of fruit on these trees.
Yes.
You didn't lie.
Right. No, they're loaded.
Is that because we got some rain?
Yeah, and it got cold. This canyon's noted for cold. Well, it lived up to it last winter. We had a lot, an extended chill period, which is extremely important for fruit trees.
The apricots in Sea Canyon, just south of San Luis Obispo near Avila Beach, are ripe for picking. 34-year veteran grower Mike Cerrone guides me on my first fruit tree adventure. The trees are heaving with fruit, probably the best crop ever, but it's not just because of the rain.
These need 450 hours below 45 degrees, and it's enhanced in here because by the winter solstice, the sun is down right in here by 12:30, and it gets shady and cold, and it stays cold till 8 in the morning. So they got the cold. They had a lot of rain right here, this exact area, 37 inches. And 3.5 of that came in May, which was a real boost to these trees. Last year, they actually had a similar crop, not as large, but it was destroyed by a blistering heat wave that was out of this world. It came through here around July 4th, if I remember, and burned a lot of the fruit. So right now we have ideal climate. This is perfect, and we're just going for it because this is a huge crop.
And it's all picked by hand?
Yeah, every last one of them.
Okay. How many trees do you have?
In this block, we have about 80. And then I have approximately 3 more blocks of 80 trees. And then I have a couple of small interplant zones. I have a lot of apricots, and they're all loaded this year. This Blenheim Grove here, I think we're now almost 23 years old.
Okay.
This used to be all apples in here, but we pulled them out and planted apricots for multiple reasons. I mean, I needed more apricots, but it's good to kind of rotate your tree crops. And so we didn't want to follow apples on apples. So we went to Blenheim's, the Blenheim apricot, that is. They like this spot. We have underground water here at about 25 feet. So we dry farm these apricots and they just find the water. And they're in it. You can see all the new shoot growth. I mean, look, we're talking like 3 feet of new shoot growth since May. So this is an amazing spot. One of the nice things about this spot is that it gets warm, but it doesn't get too hot. This isn't the Central Valley. So we can grow these Blenheims to their perfection. This is an amazing spot. This is a little fruit bowl, if you can kind of take a look here. We have a fence, but on the other side, I farmed that, and I have pears, apples, several hundred peach trees, and then more pears. But this is all part of the historical Daisy Dell Apple Ranch, which is 1916. It was the Redstone family that had it for years. It was iconic, and people would come out here every year to get their apples. Ultimately, the Redstones divided it up among the kids, and I ended up getting a part of it. One of the original descendants still lives here, Bob Redstone. And on the other side is Brad and Anita Ford. So I farm it all, and we've kept it in the tradition of Sea Canyon, dry farmed. But we've gone more from apples into multi-crop, stone fruit, apples, pears. This is Bob Redstone, by the way.
Hi, Bob. I'm Father Ian.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So this is your legacy land.
Yeah, I've been here about 34 years now.
Yeah, but how long has the family had it, Bob?
Oh, this September will be 105 years.
Okay, 105 years, and you're 34 years old.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm more like 84.
This canyon's also a blue zone. It makes people younger. And Bob's a living testament to it.
Oh, yeah.
Were you growing fruit on here before Michael took over?
No, Michael's had it ever since I've been here.
Bob and I kind of came along the same time. Bob inherited this property from his father, who got it from his father. So this is truly a Redstone legacy out here, and I've been fortunate enough to be part of it. things went crazy this year, right, Bob?
Pardon?
Don't things look good this year?
Yes. Yes, this is one of the better years.
Yeah.
We had ample rain this last winter. It came in not big gushes, so I would say 90% of it sunk in. The creek never got up real high. It got a little muddy a few times on the heavier rains, but I would say 90% of the rain stayed right on the ranch.
Yeah. This is probably, in my estimation, and I do farm multiple spots out here, this is probably the best part of the canyon. We're far enough in from the ocean where we warm up. We get good heat in here, but we're not Atascadero heat. We cool off. We get a little fog. This is a very well-balanced place with super deep soil. Bob, how deep is it? Bob knows a lot about geology.
Well, they hit bedrock at 92 feet, so that's topsoil. 92 deep, that's at this well. And the further you get toward the creek, the deeper it'll get. So I imagine it'll average about 100 foot of topsoil. That's a lot of soil.
Yeah, and it's amazing. These trees love it out here. This is one of the reasons. This canyon has like multiple reasons why it's good. One is the deep soil. Two is the underground water. Three is the winter chill that we get in here. It gets cold. We get ample rain, quite ample, and then we have a good climate. It's just kind of a magic spot. It really is. It's like a fruit bowl here, and this is a very nice area. For Sea Canyon, it really kind of opens up, and right now we're getting really good day length. The sun is setting all the way that away, which is, as a crow flies, Montana de Oro, probably 5 miles or so. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can't duplicate this spot.
One of the actual beauties of the place, you see those water maples up here?
Mm-hmm.
That means there's water real close to the surface. There's springs up here. There's a huge spring right over here. You see the water maples where they come down?
Yeah.
That water stays at about 72 degrees all the time. It's actually it's not a hot spring, it's a warm spring.
Yeah, it's pretty warm.
And same way with this one. And the beauty of it is that spring comes down and goes underground to the creek. So this is sub-irrigated all summer long. Deep, but it is irrigated. The deep soil never dries out. So even if we have a dry year, there's still water in the deeper soil.
During the peak of the drought, which was 2015, I had a well test here, and they pumped it hard for over 24 hours, and it never moved. The static level stayed the same. The water here is really good.
It's standing at 16 feet.
Right. It's crazy. So this maple grove over here has been identified as one of the largest water maple groves in the Coast Range. So there's a lot of really neat things about Sea Canyon. But it's composed of a lot of people who believe in the legacy of fruit growing in Sea Canyon.
So we're standing at your truck, and we're standing in between apricots and plums, right?
Yeah.
Those are plums. So when's plum season?
Because
it's clearly...
These are pluots, actually.
Oh, these are pluots.
Yeah.
What is a pluot?
A pluot is a hybrid of apricot and plum. I have nectarcot and nectar plums, and this one here is a prune hybrid.
How do you do that?
I don't know. I buy them.
There's an outfit out in the valley called Zager, Interspecific Hybrids. They breed them all the time. So yeah, this is a cool little cluster right in here that Bob planted of multiple pluots. And then we have an aprium over there, which is an apricot plum cross, but it's more apricot than it is plum. So yeah, you know, these are the fun things to have. And guess what? They all do really well here.
Look at that small one. It's more plums than it is leaves.
Yeah, I know. It looks like cherry. And we thinned it. Look at all the ones we knocked off.
Mike, I wanted to tell you too, that we're going to be through with that nectarcot tree in a couple of days.
That one? Oh, that one.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
The nectarine. All right, cool. Apricot.
What about the white nectarine and the plum up at the pump?
The white nectarine or the white peach?
No, the white nectarine.
We're going to...
You're going to grab it? How about the...
I got it flagged.
How about the Santa Rosa plum there?
No. This Santa Rosa plum over here, we're through with.
Okay, cool. Right. We have a little share agreement here. So here, this gives you another better view of the crop. These are still not ready, though. So, right. Which is great. This is a good thing. I mean, you don't want these all to come off at once because they tend to do it anyway. So to have part of the crop still ripening is a good thing for us.
So my neighbor has an apricot tree, and she got eight off of them. But she, my dad used to have one in his backyard, and they come all at once. And is that indicative of stone fruit, or is that just, yes, you know, sometimes it just does that?
They do. Stone fruits are kind of a little bit more rapid pace. But all fruit, you know, has its season, right? But like with peaches, we grow 15 varieties. Apricots, we grow one variety because there's really only one good one, and it's this one. But there you go. I mean, these are peaches that were picked this morning.
Oh my gosh, they're beautiful.
I know, they're crazy.
And are they soft? Oh, they are soft.
Yeah, we try to pick tree ripe. So we take this box right to the tree and grab them.
Wow.
Patrick diligently picks apricots, and you can hear the whistling of the other harvester and the ladder squeaking as Patrick reaches for the ripe fruit.
This is probably the best year I've seen since my beginning to work with Mike, and it's been a great year. The late July rain really helped out, gave extra size. This variety, too, is like something you can't get anywhere, really.
How long have you been picking fruit?
Since I was a kid, I'm Mike's son. I've been doing it since forever, since I was a kid. And yeah, it's always something I've been doing and on and off since the youth. I tell you. I mean, this is the best apricot you'll have. I think so. We kind of pick them kind of sometimes slightly green because they go to market better, I think. They got to travel. They got to make it home with the customer. And like this variety, they soften kind of from the inside out. Something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. That's like perfect, I think, for market because...
Even though it doesn't dimple when you push it.
Yeah, because it's going to sit on your counter for a day and boom, tomorrow it'll be ready. Okay. So and we try to kind of educate the customer on that. You know, the stuff you're getting at the grocery store is like ready, which isn't necessarily the best thing, I think, you know?
Right.
It's not really like true to what some varieties need, you know, and like this variety especially is, it's not meant for the mass market, you know.
There's so much, I can't believe how much fruit is on these trees. It's mm-hmm. It's astonishing. I mean, it's like grapevines rather than fruit trees. So there's so much fruit and a lot of it's still green. Mm-hmm. How long will this season, the picking season, last?
I think we're gonna go to the end of July. So we have a short window. And you can see, it's like some of this stuff, you can come out here on Monday and it'll be ready. So it turns real quick. It's starting to heat up too, as you can feel. Mm-hmm. So it's gonna go real quick, but we have enough. And you can see the different kind of shades of green and how everything's kind of trickling along. But 5 weeks, a month for apricots is really good for us. And this is the best summer I've ever seen. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's it is wild. Even like, I don't know, you can see the limbs snapping. There's too much weight, you know? Like, we had to buy extra props to keep us afloat here. So, yeah, this is a great year. We're excited.
I love the picking thing. The picking bucket.
Yeah. You latch it with the knots. Boom. And then it's like, yeah. Go through, X up. And then...
Great, and you can fill it up then, and then when you undo the latches... You
kind of dump them into the box.
There is a photo of Patrick and the cleverly engineered picking basket with the podcast.
Do you like stone fruit?
Yeah, I do. I like, you know, apricots are growing on me. I'm a yellow peach, white peach, nectarines, plums kind of guy, but yeah.
This show is called Playing with Food. I don't have to do anything with apricots in my kitchen to prove that interesting things can be done with them. That discovery was right here in the orchard.
I have a guy who just showed up who's taking 150 boxes today.
Ooh.
For beer. So they're making some special IPA Blenheim beer blend. We got them all picked, and he's going to start loading them. So here we go. These are all going to beer.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Adam Romney, and my company is Pop Produce. I'm basically a broker for fruit and just other ingredients for beer brewers in the state. I work with craft beer brewers from San Francisco to San Diego. This particular load of fruit is going to the Rare Barrel in Berkeley, and they're a fairly large-sized craft brewery in Berkeley They specialize in sour beers. It's a style of beer made with mixed cultures. A lot of beers, like mainstream beers, like IPAs are really popular, right? Those are made primarily with like laboratory strain yeast, so very controlled fermentation. This style of beer is made with called wild yeast. So like breweries will cultivate their own yeast cultures and then use those to ferment the beer. So every house has their own sort of flavor of yeast. So this is that kind of brewery. So what happens is the beer gets made, gets fermented, and then is aged in oak barrels. And this fruit, everybody's a little bit different. I think this fruit is getting added directly into already fermented beer in oak barrels. And so we'll then get aged some more. The beer will get aged some more with the fruit in it. And it imparts fruit flavors, but also acidity. And there's a secondary fermentation. So there's additional like yeast flavors that are created by adding fruit to beer.
Will it actually have the flavor of apricots?
Yeah, it will. It will read... It won't be like you're eating it off the tree, not like if you juiced it or anything like that. It will have sort of like an apricot aroma and a bit of like an apricotty stone fruit flavor, but not like a pure apricot flavor. And then there'll be like a sort of specific kind of acidity that apricots bring to beer as well that's desirable.
Okay.
So, but there won't be like the fruit gets removed from the beer. It's not like there's like apricot in the beer.
Right. So it's not as fruity as the Belgian fruit beers.
Well, I mean, there's a wide variety of styles that fall under that, but these are Belgian inspired fruit beers. Can I get one off the tree?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Two for the road.
That's okay. Yeah. I'll eat them.
The fertility of Sea Canyon is a precious gift to us here on the Central Coast. Mike's fruit stays mostly local, with some going to specialty foods like beers and jams, all of which don't travel very far. We're very lucky, but the threat of paving paradise is always looming.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Anybody in this area would be concerned about the future of the land. You can see what's going on. You know, one of my primary motivations at this point is to keep the tradition of Sea Canyon going. And Sea Canyon's traditionally been apple country and fruit country, not wine country. As much as I like wine, I'd like to see the deciduous orchards remain in Sea Canyon and the grapes be grown elsewhere. But, you know, you can't tell people what to do with their property. And my son believes in that, too, and he's working right alongside me now. So we'll keep persevering. I own some land out there. I lease some land. The people I lease from are also very committed to this concept. If we all stay together on this, you know, it's good for the community. It's good for the county. We take certain things for granted sometimes, but I know that people would be really bummed out if Sea Canyon, you know, disappeared from the apple fruit world. You know, there's pressure on the land from people with a lot of money who would love to have a sophisticated rural estate, right, smack dab in the middle of farmland. Those are things that are, you know, threatening. You see them all over this county, big, giant houses.
And the Silicon Valley, that used to be the gold standard for stone fruit, and look what it is now.
Right, and of course we're a miniature version of that, but it seems at times like that same pressure is on our doorsteps, and I think that's why I bought my property, you know, to kind of keep a solid toehold in there and at least dictate what I want on my land for a while, and that's growing this iconic fruit.
That you don't know what you've got till it's gone. We paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go? That you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
California, with all its diversity, is the most fantastic place on earth, and the Central Coast is a wonderful part of that with its own diversity of cultures, of geographies, of peoples, of food, of crops, of all sorts of things that we have been given. And may Mike and his neighbors continue to produce their iconic fruit for a very, very long time. Oh, and by the way, if you're wondering if it's apricots or apricots, Mike says that he pronounces it apricots. But if you're posh, you pronounce it apricots. Inquiring minds want to know, and now you do. This is KCPX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Issues and Ideas is taking a break for the month of August. We hope you enjoy your summer, and we'll be back in September with more local stories and interviews. In the meantime, you can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.